to the Progress Your Health podcast with your hosts, Dr. Robert Mackey and Dr. Valerie Davidson, a husband and wife team who specialize in bioidentical hormone replacement therapy and functional medicine. They're here to help you lose weight, balance hormones, and age gracefully. It's their mission to motivate, educate, and empower you to take your health to the next level. And now your hosts, hormone experts, Dr. Mackey and Dr. Davidson.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Progress Health Podcast. I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
So let's dive in. We have one here, a question from Allison. Why don't you go ahead and read it and we'll dive right in.
Sure. This was from on our website. We have a button that you can click on called Ask the Doctor, and then you can ask us any question you'd like. So this one's from Allison. I would like to know if taking vaginal biased cream has the same heart and bone health benefits as something like the patch or pellets. I've heard that it does not. Thanks.
There's a lot. So we're going to actually end up doing a few episodes here. We're going to break them down. We're going to break menopause, estrogen therapy, hormone therapy into a couple of different topics, bone, heart, brain, and we've got to throw weight in there. Those are sort of, you know, kind of the big topics. But because of this question, I think we're going to start with bone first. What are your thoughts about that question? There's a lot to, even though it's a very short question, because the way I had the website parameters set up, they only had like 180 characters. Now it's like 5,000. So she didn't have a lot of space to expound. So what are your thoughts?
Well, thank you, Allison, for sending in this question. And you're right, even though it's just a couple of sentences, there's so much we can talk about here. So like you said, we're for sure going to break this one up into bone, and then probably another episode we'll talk about the heart benefits with taking estrogen, and then also the brain benefits of taking estrogen. But in terms of the bones, maybe we should first explain a little bit about what she means by vaginal biased cream versus pellets or patches.
Yeah, right. Well, that's, like I said, that's where there's a lot to unpack there. First off, at least my thoughts anyways, why is she doing bias vaginally, right? We wouldn't probably prescribe that in the first place.
But not for bones.
Yeah, not for bones. If she's having any vaginal issues, yes, localized issues, right? We always talk about this distinction between using hormones systemically, whole body, bone, brains, and heart, or using them locally, face, vaginal tissue, wherever else, you are trying to have a localized impact from that hormone. So right off the bat, she's asking about a particular dosing route, okay, transdermal, but now through a mucous membrane, the vaginal tissue, as opposed to where we normally say to apply it on the inner thigh. The next question caveat to that would be the dosing. Right. Well, would you say it'd be the route and dosing? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'd say probably overall, big picture, estrogen therapy in general is beneficial for the bones.
Right.
There are studies on that. We have seen that. I've seen that personally from doing bone density studies on patients and then having them do hormone therapy and then doing bone density tests again a year or 2 years later and seeing a positive benefit from that. So in terms of Allison's question, yes, doing estrogen therapy has a benefit on the bones, but doing it vaginally may not. Just like she said, I've heard that it does not. Now, just to kind of break it down, biased, which I know our listeners probably already know that, but anybody that's new to listening to us, biased is a type of bioidentical hormone replacement that comprises estradiol, E2, one of the strongest estrogens in our body, and then estriol, E3, which is a very gentle estrogen. So it combines that together into, you know, as she's saying, a cream that she's applying vaginally. Now, doing biased in general is, you know, systemically for the body, it can be beneficial for the bones. Now, doing it locally, like Dr. Mackey's saying, vaginally may not, because it's probably just going to the vaginal tissues. Now, if I want to make this super complicated, like I said, estradiol is one of the strongest estrogens, E2, and estriol, E3, is one of the gentlest estrogens, and she's taking a combination of an estriol biased cream. So that estradiol, I have seen putting it on vaginally, can go into the bloodstream. So it may be going into the bloodstream, but we don't know how much, which is why whenever I'm working vaginally more locally, that's all that I'm working on when I'm treating a patient. They have vaginal atrophy, they have pain with intercourse, they have frequent urinary tract infections, they have just
incontinence.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, having that stress incontinence. Then I'll just treat it using that estriol, mainly just estriol, so I don't have to worry about the estradiol going to the bloodstream, just locally, so we can address those issues. Now, if we're working more on bones, then we would do the Bi-S, that estradiol, estriol cream, more systemically into the body, like Dr. Mackie had mentioned about applying it to the thigh. So yes, you can use Bi-S to help with bones. Now, she's kind of talking a little bit about, people might be asking, well, what are pellets and what are patches?
Yeah, right. Well, that's why it's there's a lot to, even though her question is really short, there's a lot to unpack there. So the way her question's worded, that the patch and the pellets may help with the bone, but the Bi-S does not. You and I are not a big fan of the pellets, just in general. What are your thoughts about the pellets?
Yeah, so pellets are where you cut a little incision in your kind of upper bum, and they insert estradiol and sometimes testosterone. And then when they do that for men, it's mainly just testosterone. But for women, a pellet is going to be comprised of an estradiol and then possibly a testosterone. And then they'll take a progesterone orally separately. That's usually if they have a uterus. That's a whole other story. But yeah, the pellets definitely would have an effect on the bone. But we don't normally like pellets because it's like putting in this huge bolus of hormone. And then eventually it weans off and goes down and goes down. And then you have to reapply it again. So you're kind of having these really highs of estrogen, possibly testosterone, and then really lows before you get to the next pellet. So I see a lot of symptoms of having, you know, too much of a good thing.
Yeah, right. Once you put it in, once they're implanted, you can't mess with it. It's there for, you know, the effects of that pellet being implanted is going to be there for months. Now, from a convenience standpoint, granted, you're having a minor surgical procedure to implant the pellets, but then you don't have to do anything after that. So I can understand the selling point. There's no pills to take. There's no creams. There's no lotions. There's no nothing. You get it implanted. Hopefully you don't have an infection or anything like that. I know, like, even like getting into a car and you're rubbing that area on certain things.
First few days, yeah.
Yeah, it can be a little bit tender, and sometimes you can get some issues locally. But once it's like a set it and forget it kind of thing, once it's implanted, you're sort of stuck. There's not much you can really do.
Usually like 3 months, yeah, and then by then the levels have gone down. But like I said, I've seen so many side effects of having, you know, once they put it in, it's too high, then you just got to wait it out. As opposed to, let's say you were giving someone some hormone cream and it was too high, then you just lower the dose or you take it away. Same with a patch, which is estradiol. So that's, like I said, that's a pretty strong form of estrogen. Is you can put that on. If it's too much, then you just take the patch off, or you do a lower dose patch.
Yeah. Now, one thing that isn't brought up here that sort of gets missed a lot is we're comparing, in this case, vaginal Bi-S to a patch, to a pellet.
To a systemic cream that you put on the inner thigh.
Yeah, at least the three things that she puts here, all right? This is where it's really challenging, is because those three things are all completely different. It's not that one... let's just say a vaginal cream, you and I wouldn't use Bi-S vaginally. We'd use an estriol only cream. We don't usually do estradiol vaginally, just because of bleeding and uterine lining growth and all those kinds of things. But to say that doesn't have an effect on bones in that route of entry to the body, it would not. But what's not really discussed or talked about, it really comes down to dosing. That's where I probably would make an argument for the patch in some respects, because the patch does, because it's estradiol only, it does raise blood levels pretty darn good in a lot of women. You could make the argument that it might have a more of an effect on bone density or maintaining bone density, just because you're going to raise that blood level.
Yeah, but like you said, with doing a Bi-S, an estradiol, estriol cream systemically to the inner thigh, you can still get those levels up pretty good to be able to protect the bone, but they're not too high. Because like I said earlier, you know, there is good documentation and evidence to show that estrogen in particular does have an effect on being able to, I guess we could kind of tease this part a little bit. You know, that estradiol has that effect on helping the bone form, so to help build bone, and it also has an effect on minimizing the breakdown of bone, because in our bodies are always building and breaking down bone. You know, our bones are made up, there's a couple of reasons for that. One reason is, you know, just from walking, we went for a long hike this morning, there's going to be little tiny micro tears or little micro breaks in my bones, and that's normal. And so then these, you know, the bone has to break down a little bit to be able to rebuild and kind of correct for those little fractures that always happen. You know, they're so minute. And then there's the other aspect of it is our blood. you know, our blood is in a certain pH and it can't change that pH. That pH is like 7.4, give or take like 0.05. But our blood is always in a particular pH. So if I'm having a very acidic lifestyle, then my body will actually pull calcium out of my bones to buffer my blood to keep it at that pH. So, you know, bone, people think, oh, you know, bone is bone, but it's really, you know, it's a living tissue.
Yeah. Yeah. It has its own blood supply. What you're talking about is very much, you go for a walk, you're doing some kind of weight bearing exercise. You're creating inflammation as you do that. That breaking down of the bone is an inflammatory process. Maybe not even breaking down, repairing that is an inflammatory process. So your body breaks it down. And then the inflammatory process then rebuilds that bone. So it's in this constant back and forth sort of cycle between breaking it down and building it back up. The whole idea of maintaining bone density, what we're talking about is making sure that building of the bone outpaces the breaking down of the bone. For those of you that don't know, this is called osteoclastic activity. That's the breaking down the bone, and osteoblastic, blast meaning building. That's what builds up the bone.
So with estrogen, you know, estrogen actually has an effect on osteoblasts. So osteoblasts, it actually kind of reduces osteoblastic death. So when you have estrogen in the system, your osteoblasts, which build bone, are able to live a little longer in your body. When you have estrogen in your system, estrogen actually decreases the lifespan and increases up the death or apoptosis of osteoclasts. So you will have, in some ways, make this super simple, is you have a little bit less breakdown of the bone and more building of the bone when you have estrogen in the body. So in the end equation is you have positive bone formation, as opposed to in menopause, when that estrogen drops, that's, you know, at lower estrogen causes those osteoclasts, the ones that break down the bone, to go up a little bit. They have a little bit longer lifespan. And then also too, when estrogen drops, it causes those osteoblasts to actually drop down. So your net bone formation is actually less. That's why after menopause, we get at 51, we get our DEXA scan, which tells us our bone density. Then we do it again 2 years later, and darn it, look, that bone density is a little bit less. It's a little bit less. That's why there's so many medications out there trying to work on osteoporosis, when really it's about that building and that breakdown of the bone.
And which is sort of controlled by the hormones. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a few things that kind of work in disadvantage to humans, a sedentary lifestyle, not enough protein, too much sugar, too much stress, not enough vitamin D, all these different factors are going to make that in some ways, almost this inevitable decline, it's going to kind of speed that up, or it's going to solidify that your bone density is going to, as you just said, is going to get gradually worse and worse year by year.
So our goal, so just actually circle around a little bit differently here. So for osteoporosis, so women with lower bone density, it's women. I think I know two men. I've had two male patients that have osteoporosis.
We were at your parents' yesterday.
Family friend, he has osteoporosis.
Yeah, he's like a computer programmer, tall, skinny, no muscle mass.
He's also got some chronic, he's got some other disease or other processes going in his body. But my point is that men don't get osteoporosis.
No, typically
women
they don't. Yeah,
and women get it after menopause.
Yeah, right. So we are doing a little bit of research, to prepare for this. This little picture that you printed up is actually very good. I like the pictures.
You like pictures.
Yeah. As I'm like a little kid, I like the visuals, right? And it's, a lot of science going on in that picture. It's really good. But I was saying that estrogen, for both males and females, estrogen plays a very vital role in the maintenance of, of the bone tissue. So that's why when women go through menopause and all that estrogen kind of disappears, right? Inevitably, it's going to disappear. That's why women are sort of at a little bit more of a disadvantage, because they're reliant on that hormone up until menopause. Now that hormone is taken away, and now they're kind of left with nothing in some respects. Now you throw in the stress of modern day life and the lack of activity for a lot of women. Now, I will say though, I'm looking at social media and YouTube and Instagram and things, I see a lot of women 50 plus that are like pumping iron and lifting weights and actually trying to build muscle. It's a really nice thing to see from a longevity perspective, because when you and I were children, back in the 70s and 80s, people in their 50s were not lifting weights. right? They could barely get out of the chair. You know, maybe you're like your grandmother or something. How many times you see people, they try to get out of a chair and they, you know, they have to try four or five times to get out of a chair.
Or they just use their hands, you know, what is it? Subconsciously, or they're not even thinking about it, and they're using their hands to, you know, to pull themselves up.
Yeah, I remember we've talked about my Auntie Vivi. I call her Auntie Vivi, but she was really like my grandmother. My grandmother passed when I was really young, and Auntie Vivi was a short woman, but you know, she was a little bit heavier. Kind of had a, you know, a big rear end, as my dad would say, and she'd try to rock herself forward to get off the. To get out of the couch or the chair, and mm-hmm. take her, you know. Now, granted, at the time when I was a little kid, she was already probably in her 80s, her early 80s. So she was, you know, she was an elderly woman for sure. But she lived to be 99. But she would have to, you know, three or four attempts to kind of get off, you know, to get off the chair. And she had like a dowager's hump. She had a definite hump in her upper spine. So she was a little hunched over with her walker, you know, cute as a button. But, you know, that's an extreme example. But now we have patients that are not, you know, let's say she was 80 years old when I was observing that behavior. We have patients that are in their 70s that are not anywhere close to that kind of aging decline, so to speak. It's changed drastically in our lifetime.
Yeah. So you're right. Doing weight bearing exercise or maintaining muscle mass is great for maintaining bones. Now, I don't know what when you were talking about Auntie Vivi. So having that muscle mass helps improve bone structure, but it's not necessarily by way of doing estrogen therapy.
Say it again. No.
Well, because we're kind of breaking this down a little bit, and I've run into this all the time with some of my patients. They're like, you know, my bone density is osteopenia, or I've got osteoporosis. I need hormones. I need hormones to help my bones.
Yeah.
And I say, yes, that is one aspect that is going to help with your bone density, but there's so many other aspects
too,
like you said, is doing that weight bearing exercise. Cause like I was mentioning, we went for this long hike earlier before this podcast.
And we worked out before we went for the hike.
Yes, we did. So there are little micro, you know, tiny, tiny micro fractures in the bones that need to be rebuilt. So there's a two part process to that. Is when you do exercise, you are able to make that bone stronger afterwards.
Yeah,
exercise right. makes your bone stronger, not just because of the, you know, the physical activity of it, but then also too, building that muscle maintains bone.
Yeah, right. I mean, it is, you're right. It is a hormonal, there's a hormonal effect to it, but then there's also a muscular, the dynamic between the muscle and the bone. You need one to maintain the other, right? I mean, obviously, that's why all that activity is such a necessary idea. Our bodies, that's why in space, bone density is a big issue in space. You are in a weightless environment for weeks and weeks and weeks. Your bones atrophy very quickly. Even men have bone density problems the longer they're in space because you're weightless. There's no load on your skeletal structure. So that part that you're talking about, there's nothing forcing the bone to have to rebuild itself. That's a really big deal. Now you have a sedentary lifestyle, no more hormone, right? That's why this is what we're talking about. The fracture risk goes up immensely over time. By the time a woman is in her 60s, 70s, right? I'm sure it even starts probably, you know, like you said, 51 and a half, I think that's changing a little bit for some part of the population, the ones that are maintaining their activity, but the ones that are not, and then you throw in a high sugar, high stress lifestyle, no sleep, low vitamin D levels. And now that, that's sort of a recipe for disaster.
So like I was saying before about the pH of the body. So this has nothing to do, you know, like I said, estrogen helps bone, but other things don't help bone. Smoking makes your blood very acidic. Drinking tons of soda and sugar can actually make your blood a little bit acidic. Eating tons of, you know, which I love my animal protein, but let's say that's all you're doing is that's very acidic. So when that blood pH wants to change to be more acidic, the body will say, okay, we got to buffer this blood. So then it pulls a little bit of the calcium out of the bones. So I was just saying earlier is actually, you know, trying to maintain a very anti-inflammatory lifestyle can also be really beneficial for the bones.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And that's a whole nother, you know, thing we'll kind of dive into, you know, later on. But now see what you just brought up about protein. There's a balance there. Maintaining bone is made out of protein, right? You need amino acids in order to make bone. You know, where is that fine line between too much protein making your blood acidic potentially versus how much, you know, you have this amino acid pool in your body that your body is using as building blocks for all these different structures. How do you effectively maintain that?
I wouldn't say like, you know, animal protein is straight up inflammatory. I mean, yeah, sure, there's arachidonic acid and meats and whatnot, but it's when you combine it with sugar or any refined carbohydrate. So, you know, bread and meat, as opposed to like meat and greens. You know, greens are very anti-inflammatory. Greens are very more alkaline for the system. So I would say, kind of like you said, is we want to keep our protein up. If your protein drops as a female, that's terrible, not only for your muscle mass, but that's terrible for your bone density as well. But I would say is keeping that protein up, but then pairing it with more, you know, like we've always said, more of a whole foods diet rather than a processed refined sugar diet.
Absolutely. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. Cause the protein, there's no way around it. The protein, there's some, recent research that I came across saying that, somebody, Dr. Atiyah or somebody online was talking about that your protein requirement, it's the only macronutrient that goes up over time, right? Our body needs more protein as things go forward. And I think we're still sort of, I wouldn't say anti-protein, that we have kind of two factions. There's some part that say protein's great and promotes protein and encourages protein. And there's another part that we're sort of avoiding, at least the animal protein side. There are people that are sort of avoiding that. And I don't think they're, for what we're talking about, I don't think they're doing their body or their bones any favors in that respect.
No, you're right. Eating the protein, and you always tell this to me because I have a hard time doing that, is eat your protein, where I'm kind of like, oh, well, I'll just do a little extra collagen powder because it's got 12 grams of protein for a scoop. And oh, let's make a protein powder shake. Like, that's easy for me. But sometimes eating the protein, so I get it, because I talk to a lot of women and I'm like, you know, it's hard to get that protein in to eat it. But making that effort, I do think is important. But at the same time, I still like my collagen powder with my 12 grams of protein in it.
You need to eat it, not drink it. I know. Right? You need to eat it first and then drink it last. But everyone wants to do it the other way because it's easy. Right? You put your collagen powder in your coffee or in a, you know, you have your, you know, granted, I'll do a protein,
tea.
Mm-hmm. I'll do a protein shake, you know, every now and then as well too. That's simple and easy. But I, you know, even myself, like I'm, you know, a pretty big guy. So I'm trying to get to a minimum of 200 grams of protein a day. Have you gotten to 100 recently?
No, but I try really hard to get to about 70. I can do 70. At 70, I can do, but it's so hard to get to 100.
Yeah. I'm encouraging women all the time. Get your protein.
We're all working
and
on it.
And 75 is like the first target. Honestly, 50 should be, for some women, 50 is the first target. Get to 50, get to 75. And pretty much in my opinion, based on, you know, maybe a little bit on weight, but pretty much every woman should be close to 100 grams of protein a day. Men, depending, or if you're trying to lose weight, then at least get to your target weight in grams of protein. If you're trying to be 120 pounds, get to 120 grams of protein. That is a good target. I don't expect women to eat their body weight in grams of protein necessarily, right? That's probably not going to happen. Men, I think, have a little bit of an easier time in that respect. But if you're over 200 pounds, 200 grams of protein, that's a lot of protein. You cannot intermittent fast and you're still able to get your protein amount in on a daily basis. So there's some contradictions there as how we go about that on a daily, weekly basis and still giving our body the building blocks that it needs in order to, you know, maintain these tissues.
So I think the point we're making here is, yes, I've done hormone replacement with women for over 20 years. I do believe it's great for the bones, but it's not the only puzzle piece. Like you were saying, the protein, the weight-bearing exercise, you'd even mentioned, something about vitamin D, which yes, vitamin D and calcium are really important
critical,
for the bones.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Critical. I think now too, that we're kind of shying away, at least from what the research says, shying away from the high dose calcium days from the early 90s. And when we were young, a little bit younger, you know, 1200 milligrams of calcium, I think we're kind of leaning away from that, where most of the attention is being put on the vitamin D. Now we're starting to see a little bit more of a trend since COVID too. Everyone now is sort of kind of aware, at least from an immune system perspective, is aware of vitamin D. How many abnormal vitamin D levels have you seen since COVID?
I still see some. Vitamin D is, for a lot of patients that I talk to, have a tough time taking it. They always forget. And I say, don't forget. It's so important. And then I have other patients, their vitamin D levels are way too high. I'm like, we got to back off, girls. So
what's the in the last few years, what's the highest level you've seen yet?
Oh, not like 150, I think.
I've seen it probably at least, I don't know, 4 to 6 over 200.
Oh yeah, that's too high. Yeah, yeah. Vitamin D is fat soluble. You won't have that high for that long.
Now, I don't know. Do you even know what vitamin D toxicity even looks like? Have you ever seen it? I've never seen vitamin D.
No, I haven't.
I've never seen vitamin D deficiency, like, you know, rickets or anything like that. You know, those things don't really happen necessarily in a modern society necessarily. But yeah, I've seen quite a few since COVID. I've seen quite a few elevated vitamin D's, certainly well over 100. And I've seen a few that are over 200. I'm like, okay, we gotta stop that for a little while. We gotta tone it back.
But I like the enthusiasm because it is good for the immune system, but it is really good at helping calcium go into the matrix of the bone.
Well, and I heard somebody else talk about this, which I thought was a really good point, that Mother Nature does not make mistakes, right? Mother Nature is very, our bodies are designed in a way to make everything as efficient. And if our body is the only vitamin we can actually create in the body is vitamin D, then it's for a very good, important reason, right? The body does not do that or spend energy on something that is not important, right?
Just so, like the K2.
Yeah.
Right. Our digestive system, our gut microbiome makes K2.
Yeah, right.
And then, of course, we can take it as a supplement, which we do that too.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing too. Everyone's saying now, do you need to take the K2 with the D3? I think that it's I don't think you need to take them together. I think it's a good idea. You know, that's the way you and I, you do it most of the time. You know, there might be some instances where vitamin D by itself is okay. But you know, you're having that kind of you're enhancing or improving that calcium metabolism by making sure there's enough vitamin D and K2 there at the same time.
And then I know K2, as probably a lot of our listeners know too, is K2 helps the calcium go into the bone, but not go into the arterial wall. So that's kind of like one of the vitamin K2's job is to keep that calcium from becoming atherosclerosis in those arteries. So I use a lot of vitamin D just on its own, like with people under the age of 30, under the age of 40. For men, I always use the K2 because there are more risk for cardiovascular disease or atherosclerosis, what do they call it, the Widowmaker and the Grim Reaper.
Yeah, yeah. The Widowmaker is if a man has a heart attack, the LAD, the left anterior descending artery. If you ever look at a picture of the heart, the artery that comes right down the front of the heart, that's called the LAD. And if you have a heart attack in that one is the one that usually kills men. Hence, they call it the Widowmaker.
And right? Then what's the Grim Reaper? Is that the RCA?
Right coronary artery. That's the other one. And I've seen, and I both have seen quite a few coronary calcium scores. And those are the two most predominant arteries that are going to have most of the calcification. Atherosclerosis. Now we're getting off on another tangent. We're talking about bones. Now we're going right into the heart. But that's why these things are also interconnected. It's just, fascinating and fun to talk about. The LAD, most of the atherosclerosis is going to be in the LAD the majority of the time. The next most common is going to be the RCA, the right coronary artery. Those two, at least the coronary calcium scores that I've seen, those two predominate most of the plaque formation. Atherosclerosis means hardening of the arteries. The hardening part is calcium deposition in your arteries. That's why you can do a quote-unquote X-ray. I'm doing air quotes right now because it'd probably be better if it was on video. That's why you do a CT, which is a fancy X-ray, because now you can see calcified tissue on there to see how much calcification or scar tissue is in those coronary arteries.
Yeah, so that's a good reason if you're taking your vitamin D3 is to take it with the K2 as well. So I guess back to bones.
Yeah. So a little bit of a tangent. So we're going to do another one on heart fairly soon because estrogen also has an impact on cholesterol and LDL and ApoB and LP little a and all these different things. And menopause has some changes too. That's why women's risk of heart disease goes up once they hit menopause, because I think they're losing same thing. As the estrogen goes down, they're losing the protection from the estrogen, which is why they become more susceptible to to osteoporosis and heart disease after menopause, because they're, you know, and that's why the, there's a big distinction between males and females in that respect. The estrogen is actually very protective for them. And now they're, you know, the playing field or the disease risk is sort of leveled once they go into menopause, because they're not producing it anymore. So if you think about hormone replacement from that standpoint, it is not only helping in the short-term symptom mitigation, right? Hot flashes, night sweats, improving your sleep. But there is a long-term benefit to it, where you're literally preventing age-related disease. And we've known that, we've believed that, we've, you know, we sort of preach that with our patients on a regular basis. But just now, like, we've seen this kind of progression over our, from being in school to being in practice to now, there's been this wave of differences, you know, how the mindset around hormones is changing. Well, what have you noticed in that, you know, 20 plus years?
Oh yeah, no, before, well, even now I still see there's still some doctors, and I, hey, you can't be the jack of all trades. They don't have any idea what hormone replacement is. It's still, but then I have a lot that actually are pretty open to it, and they send their patients to me.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So things have changed. I would like to, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned something about calcium and how, because I remember it used to be 1200 milligrams of calcium. Have you heard different?
That it's actually could be more potentially harmful, that it could be contributing to atherosclerosis and some of those heart disease risks. By high dose, you know, 1200 milligrams would be considered a high dose of calcium, that it could actually be, it could be more of a risk factor than a benefit.
Yeah, because of that atherosclerosis. I mean, I'm not, I do think if you took your, I do take calcium with, you know, the K2 and the vitamin D, I think that could probably help prevent some of that, you know, that idea of adhering the calcium to the arterial walls. And there's so many other reasons for that. But I will say, calcium is such a big molecule. Have you ever tried to take 1200 milligrams of calcium?
It's a lot.
It's so miss. Those tablets are huge. Yeah. So I'll say, you know, back in the day when we were saying, hey, take, you know, 1000 milligrams of calcium, a lot of women wouldn't do it because that's a lot of capsules to take. That's a lot of tablets to take.
Yeah, you can only get so much into a capsule. Oh.
Plus, on top of your other supplements, it's like a part-time job.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that the trend over the last, you know, several years, maybe even the last 10 years, has been, at least in the functional space anyways, conventionally, I think they're still pushing calcium. But women nowadays are asking about their vitamin D as opposed to focusing so much on the calcium. There's more of an awareness that the vitamin D is more where the attention should be placed. And they're de-emphasizing the role of the calcium.
Well, usually for my patients, I'll say, you know, they want to take calcium. I'll say, you know, take, because it is hard to get enough calcium in food. You know, you can only eat so many almonds, and who wants to eat all that kind of dairy? There are some green leafies that you can get some calcium from, but the, you know, tofu has some calcium. So there are certain foods that are high in calcium. So I'll usually tell women to take 500 milligrams of supplemental calcium, then try to get 500 milligrams dietarily. So really try to work on that. Then take their vitamin D3, and then we test it to make sure it doesn't get too low or too high. And then we, you know, with some K2, that's probably, and then honestly, I've actually been adding in, as I mentioned before, a little bit of certain particular collagen powders that have different nutrients in it for bones. Because a lot of people want to take calcium, a lot of people want to take collagen, and they put it, you know, I like to put the collagen in my tea, and they want to take that because it's good for the hair, skin, and nails. But there are certain collagens that you can get that actually are a little bit more specific for bones.
Yeah, right, absolutely.
So I've been working a little bit more with doing it that way, and then adding in the protein, and then kind of, like you said, sort of, kind of making the calcium a little bit more on the back burner.
Yeah. And maybe, like you said, a little bit of supplementation with the calcium, more from the diet. The vitamin D is the tough one because there's not really any, I mean, can you think of any good dietary sources of vitamin D?
No, but I will tell you, there was one patient I saw, this was a number of years ago, and her, she didn't take vitamin D, but her vitamin D was like 65. And she was very tan because she was in tanning bed.
Oh,
it does. It actually gives, you know, you can raise up your levels of vitamin D from a, you know, from a tanning bed, but at the same time, that's not, you know, that's not really,
yeah.
If you're a freckler like me and you know, and wrinkled, it's not great for that either.
Probably not good from a photo aging.
But I was very surprised when I saw that.
Yeah. But we've also, you know, with you know, the promotion of sunscreen and different things, we've also been sort of afraid of the sun. Way back to the ozone days, back in the 90s, right? They're always talking about the ozone layer is disappearing and don't use your aerosol sprays. You don't hear about that anymore.
Well, I don't use my Aquanet anymore either.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. I just lost my train of thought.
About getting vitamin D sources from the sun versus dietary.
We're sort of afraid of the sun, but the sun, I mean, honestly, we're supposed to be spending all of our time in the sun, all day, every day in the sun. Now, if you're blonde hair, blue eyed like I am, you only spend, you know, 6 months of the year in the sun and then 6 months in the cold where your body's covered up. So you build up your vitamin D stores in the summertime and then you you use them up in the wintertime and then you rebuild them again. We don't really live that kind of a lifestyle anymore. We're always inside. Now, the funniest thing is when we used to live in the Southwest, everybody had low vitamin D in the Southwest. Okay, pre-COVID, everybody was either, the reference range for vitamin D, as everybody knows, is between 30 to 100. Everybody was either in the high 20s or the low 30s. Some, you get a one offhanded person here or there that'd be in the teens. I had one patient the other day said that her vitamin D at one point was in the single digits. It was like 9 or something like that. I never seen it. That was before I met her, whatever, but for a good long while. Now the trend is a little bit different. Now everyone's aware of the importance of vitamin D. People are supplementing with it. Like you said, though, some people just forget to take it, right? So they either take way too much or they don't take enough, and you have like two ends of the spectrum.
Took yours this morning.
Well, you gave it to me.
I put it in your tea.
Yeah. That's fine. Yeah, I like to use the drops. You like to use the soft gels for the vitamin D.
Oh, both. Actually, I've been liking the drops lately because it's just easy to put, five drops in the tea.
One drop, very concentrated, 1,000 IUs. What would you say, just from a dosing perspective, what would you say is an average? Like, where would you, with the drops, 1,000 IUs per drop.
Usually because I work mainly with females for vitamin D, 5,000 IUs daily with 45 micrograms of K2 is a pretty good dose for an average female, that you're not going to go over 100, but you're not going to go under 30. That usually keeps you around like 55 to 65.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think that 50 to 75, somewhere in there, I think is a good point. My point is, you're going to assume if you're giving them 5,000 as a daily dose, they're not going to remember 7 days of the week. Now, some people are very religious, very regimented. They have good discipline. They take it every day. Most people, what I hear a lot is people take it Monday through Friday and they miss it on the weekends, right? So
You've got your little granny containers where you just fill them up for 3 weeks or a month.
Well, right. But they have their work routine and then they have their weekend routine. So they remember it on their work routine and then they miss it on their weekend routine, which I think is totally fine. Because that way you're going to maintain the level, but then you're not going to necessarily take too much. But I'd say, honestly, probably somewhere between, now granted, we're talking about bones and osteoporosis. If someone's osteoporotic, then that we might be pushing that dose up a little bit. Be closer to 10,000, in a lot of cases. Or if it's really low, we might even use, and I've done this a few times, where I use a 50,000. There's a company called Biotech, and they have a really good 50,000 IU vitamin D, one a week for several weeks, in addition to the oral drops, that we were talking about, build up that level really quickly. And certainly from a bone and an immune system standpoint, it's a way to push up those levels quickly and maintain them over time. I'd say average 5,000, maybe as low as 2, up to 10, depending on the situation, or higher if the situation warrants it. But that's usually something else significant is going on at that point.
So since we're talking about bones and bone density, do you think we should touch a little bit on DEXA scans and bone density scans?
That's what everyone, that's where this information is coming from, right? So they go in, they get their DEXA scan. Nobody knows how to read it. It just says on there osteopenic, osteoporotic. And women do sort of, their bone maintaining their bone density is important to them, as it should be. Why don't you dive into the parameters for a DEXA scan?
Well, yeah, the DEXA scan, which is a bone density scan. I guess what I said earlier, it is pretty common. Usually when you hit about 51 is when you probably want to get your first DEXA scan, and it'll give you an idea of what your bone density is. And then you, usually depending on what your bone density is, you'll do it every 2 years, every year. Some people get to wait 5 years because I have a handful of women whose bone density in their 50s is like a zero. Like they have no bone density loss. It's amazing. But for most of us,
so what is the common theme in their lifestyles?
You know, in the ones that I'm thinking of, they're probably maybe a little genetics. I have a couple of patients I can think of, and I'm like, how in the world is your bone density actually positive and you're over the 50?
What does that mean? You're surprised by that? Mm-hmm. They're not doing certain things that would encourage that. They're not active. They're not lifting weights.
A few of them, of course, you know, doing all the things we talked about with the dietary, the anti-inflammatory lifestyle, doing the weights, doing the hormone replacement, you know, those things are contributing. But I do think there are some people that have some really good genetics and they have no bone density loss.
No, I disagree. I think it has very little to do with genetics. I think it has everything to do with lifestyle. You could have good genetics and have a bad lifestyle, and your bones are going to be like Swiss cheese. You're going to lose that bone density very quickly. That's why that's interesting that you have some that are, they don't have to worry. If they have it in their 50s like that, then they're going to be good forever for the most part. They're going to be in a really good situation when it matters, when they're 75 plus. They won't have to worry about, falling and breaking a hip, which it's not about breaking the hip per se. It's the complications or the issues that happen after breaking the hip. Literally breaking a hip is actually fatal. I don't know what the statistics are on that, but it's actually a significant cause of mortality, 75 plus or something after breaking a hip. What is the adage? I've heard somebody say, you break a hip, you die of pneumonia, because you end up in the hospital for too long. And then, something happens or, a nosocomial infection from the hospital or something. And now your life expectancy is a little bit shorter because of breaking that hip. So certainly hip fracture is a really big deal, which is why this osteoporosis thing is, is so important to women, obviously.
Oh, absolutely. That's why I do think it's a good idea to get a DEXA scan. I don't tell people, hey, do all these things, but I say, if you're going to get a screening, a DEXA scan is a great screening. They've changed the parameters. So if any of you have gotten a DEXA scan, you've gotten what's called a T-score. So they'll tell you a T-score. 0 is no bone loss. If there's any positive, that means you actually have positive bone density.
How often do you see that? You see positive, not often, a positive score?
To be honest, often.
It's usually always negative something, 0 or negative something.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like I said, there's one patient I can think of offhand, which is one I wouldn't have thought would have a positive bone density, and she does. It's amazing.
Yeah. So, how old is she?
Now she's probably 59.
Oh, wow. Really? 59?
Yeah. When I first did, when we did the other one, because her insurance won't pay for it now until she waits 5 years. Because she had positive bone density. She's going to pay. She ended up paying out of pocket to do it after 2 years. Because, the whole goal that I tell with women is, sure, it'd be awesome if we could build bone, but it is very hard to do that once you hit menopause. And if you're, a fair petite female, it's inevitable you're going to lose some bone. So our goal is to really just maintain what we have and not lose.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, that should be the strategy. Is you're not going to, even with the medications that are out there for osteoporosis, you're not going to dramatically increase your bone density. What you're really trying to do is just slow the progression, right? I mean, would that be a reasonable strategy?
Yeah, so like I was saying, the hormone replacement is amazing, but it's just one piece of the puzzle to maintaining your bone density. And I have had some patients where we've worked really hard to build bone density, because there'll be some, like I was saying, so a 0 T-score is no bone loss. Osteopenia goes up to a -1. So if you're a -0.5, your bone's fine. If you're negative 0.8, you're fine. You go to -1.0, you've got osteopenia. Now back in, I want to say maybe it was 2010 they changed it, or maybe 2008. So prior to that, osteopenia was a -1.5. And then they changed it to -1 to say you have osteopenia for whatever reason that
interesting.
Is.
But as interesting. Of now. So they reduced the threshold for osteopenia.
Yes. So as of now, to be osteopenic, not osteoporosis, osteopenic, is a -1 to a -2.5. Once you hit -2.5, that's osteoporosis. And the more negative that it, -2.5, -2.6, I've seen -4s. Now there's other reasons for that.
I wonder about my mom's bone density.
Your mom is so tiny. She's like a little bird.
She had a thyroid problem a couple of years ago, and she was down to 88 pounds, I think is her lowest weight. Now I think she's getting a little chubby and she's a little over 100.
Gosh. Yeah. She thinks she's chubby.
That's what she thinks. Yeah. She doesn't want to, she's trying not to gain any weight.
She's adorable.
Yeah. Yeah. But she's, she's going to be 78 in June. So she's getting up there, but yeah, she's, She's very petite. I can't imagine. I would imagine her bone density is probably like -4 or even worse than that.
She said that her bone density isn't great. She doesn't know what a T-score is, but she said it's not.
She's definitely osteoporotic. I just don't necessarily know, you know, how osteoporotic she actually is. She fell a few years ago. Again, of course, she lives in Wisconsin. They have crazy winters there, and she slipped on some ice. And thank God she didn't break her hip, but she broke her wrist.
Her head.
Or fall backwards and, have a concussion or something. She fell and broke her wrist, and she's still, the bone didn't set right, or they didn't set it right. They did surgery on it. She's had a few surgeries on it, and now she, thank God, has her left hand, not her right hand. She's right-handed like I am. She's having a hell of a time with that left hand. She can't really, she's got like permanent kung fu grip on her left hand. Like, she can't use the fingers, and she can't bend her wrist, and it's pretty much, non-functional. She's been to, occupational therapy, and it doesn't really seem to help. And she went and saw another hand specialist, and he even said, too, that not sure by having another procedure if she can regain any function, and which is,
Oh, that's okay. Terrible.
Yeah, that's sad. Yeah.
But that's, how you mentioned earlier about the astronauts and gravity?
Yeah.
So your mom has always been a tiny little woman for as long as I've known her. She's a little woman, so a fair, petite female, so that's less body weight, less gravity on the ground, they're going to lose bone.
Less muscle mass, yeah.
Less muscle mass, less body weight, less body mass on the ground for gravity. That's why walkers and runners and hikers can really, they have good bone density because of that body weight on gravity. It's like I was saying earlier, you're a fair, petite, tiny, little woman with less muscle mass, you're going to lose bone. So the goal is to try to preserve it and maintain it. So people that are, of course, a little bit heavier or bigger, like I said, runners, hikers, they usually tend to have really good bone density.
Yeah. Now there's on the other end of that spectrum, it's some of those endurance people though, they do too much and more breakdown.
How many people are that? Percentage wise? How many? What are they? Yeah, ultra marathons? Do you know? True. I know two people in my whole life.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the majority of the population. Well, we just need to get people moving more. As opposed to that small segment. You're totally right. She's like I said, she's gonna be 78. Mm-hmm. This is when it sort of, what you're doing in your 40s, 50s, even in your 60s is going to matter up to that point, where your bones, your bones don't become a liability. That's why even some of the talk with semaglutide and some of the weight loss medications right now, you're losing muscle mass. If you're losing muscle mass, you can assume you're losing bone density at the same time. It might be great to lose a few pounds when you're a little bit younger, but that's going to potentially, if you don't take account for that, it's going to potentially come back to haunt you later on when it really matters the most. So hopefully everyone's keeping those all encompassing ideas in their mind as they're making some of those decisions, because it could be at some point it could be catastrophic.
No, so just to kind of circle back and answer Allison's question, the vaginal bias cream, probably not. And one thing, not to make things more complicated, a lot of times when you're using hormones vaginally, you may not be using them every day. There's a few people that do.
Probably
do it
shouldn't be.
But they're not using it every day because it's for vaginal atrophy and working on that localized. So for Allison, that vaginal bias probably isn't having really much of an effect on the bone and the heart. Now, the pellets in the patch of estradiol, sure, that would be great for the bones, but there could be some side effects from being a little bit too strong. I do feel like, because this is what I've done for 20 years, is doing like a bias systemically would have, have a nice effect on the bone density, the heart, which we'll get into later, without having some of the negative side effects of being too strong.
Yeah, yeah. And then it comes down to the dosing,
plus the other pieces of the puzzle for bone density.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah.
You can't do hormones and then, not eat enough or, not exercise or be sedentary and expect, why aren't my bones better on my DEXA scan? I do my hormones.
Yeah,
that's true. That's not the only piece.
Yeah. Testosterone does play a role. I have a few patients that we sort of, we have some estrogen on board, systemically, as you're talking about, we also add in some testosterone there to help. Now the couple of people that I'm thinking of directly, they're very active. So they're getting kind of the benefit of the, maintaining muscle, actively trying to build muscle, that is going to translate, as we've been talking about, into the bones very nicely. So I'm making sure that there's kind of a three-pronged approach there. You have your estrogen replacement. If you're using estrogen, you have to have the progesterone. So that balance is in place.
If you have a uterus, yeah.
If you have a uterus, and then you add in the testosterone. And the one that I'm thinking of specifically, there's a few that I'm thinking of specifically. We kind of push the envelope on that testosterone, and it pushes it beyond the reference range as long as they don't have any of the unwanted cosmetic things, no pimples, no hair growth, things like that. Then it's perfectly okay to have a higher testosterone level. And because of this fact specifically, because of the bones, it's sort of encouraged to have a little bit of a higher blood level. So, anything else to say about menopause, estrogen, and bone density?
Probably, but I can't think of it right now. Right.
We're going to circle back around. This is going to come up probably a million more times because this is an important topic, and there's we're just scratching the surface on it. There's a lot more we can kind of dive into and talk about. So we appreciate Allison's question. Again, if you have your own questions, go to visit our website, find the Ask the Doctor tab, put in your name, email, ask the question. We'll read it on the podcast. Until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Progress Your Health podcast. If you like what you've heard on this podcast, please give us a positive review on iTunes. This allows us to spread our message, grow our audience, and help more people around the world. For more information, visit our website at progressyourhealth.com.